Dirty hands means clean theology. Can you dig it? What is going on, all my local guys and gals and long distance pals?
We're back.
Yes, we are. It's good to see you fellas. Excited to you know, be back in the fold, you know, starting, kind of kicking off our fourth season. Our first guests of the fourth season are with us today. It's pretty crazy. It's been four seasons of this, I should say, but excited to talk about what we're going to talk about tonight. But what do you think? You want to get started? You want to pray?
Yeah, let's just get into it.
Let's do it. Go ahead, Justin.
Dear kind, gracious Heavenly Father, thank you for today. Thank you for the many blessings that you've given us. Thank you for this time together for fellowship and just unwind, and also to dig through your word and your treasures. And we're just thankful for these brilliant men that have joined us today and blessed us with their time and their presence to talk about some of the gold nuggets that you revealed to them. And we're just really appreciative for your revelations for these men and them giving their time to us today. And we just pray that those that need to hear this for some validation or to sharpen their swords to defend their faith or just scratch that knowledge itch they got, Father, we pray those people hear this message today and our words be edifying. And we're just thankful for the blood of Jesus Christ. Amen.
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 Amen. Well, today we are blessed. We have the maverick archaeologist with us, Dr. Aaron Judkins, but they've just written a book together on Göbekli Tepe. And Dr. Judkins, why don't you jump in and tell us just a little bit about your book and what motivated you guys to write that? And then we'll dive in a little further, a little deeper.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, this book is about a site in southeastern Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. And about 5-6 years ago, Judd and I really started looking at this pretty hard. And I asked Judd, I said, hey, you know, would you be interested in co-writing a book with me on this? But, you know, I had said no several times. I had a guy that had asked me several times. His name's Roger, lives up in Canada, has followed my work for years. And he said, Dr. Judkins, you got to look, you know, have you looked at Göbekli Tepe? I said, yeah, I know about it. I referenced it in one of my early books called Alien Agenda, The Return of the Nephilim, back in 2012. So I had heard about it, but I hadn't really considered it. And so I started taking another look at it. And what I had thought was an idea of what I thought it was not. I was totally wrong about what I thought it was because I hadn't studied it. I just thought maybe it was related to, you know, a ceremonial site related to Noah's Ark because it was in the region hundreds of miles away, but still within the region. And so, you know, had animals, you know, carved into the stones. And so I just said, well, it's just a ancient site probably dedicated to the memorial of the flood and Noah's Ark and all this. So I didn't really put a lot of time or effort into it initially. And then when I started to take another look at it, I quickly realized that all my preconceptions about the site had been wrong. And so I started digging in further to try to understand what this site was. And unfortunately there was no one single source where you could just pull all this information together. And so, man, it took me on a journey of trying to dig and find just little nuggets here and there and piece those together and, you know, hunting down sources and reading books and articles and journals and anything I could to try to understand what was happening at the site. And it was a big puzzle. And so this is how the journey really started for me.
That's pretty awesome. Now, I want to ask one question, and I'm going to be honest and 100% transparent. I'm stealing this from your last interview because I think it's so important. I actually listened to your interview with Derek Gilbert, and absolutely love Derek, you know, obviously friend of the show, and just an amazing individual. But when we talk about these things, and I mean, you can look at this in a broad spectrum. We're talking about Göbekli Tepe tonight. You could talk about so many other historical sites. You could talk about Petra. You could talk about a lot of these other amazing places you've been, you know, Ararat. I guess the best way to say this, and Derek kind of put it this way. He goes, explain to us and to our listeners, because this is so important, why looking into this stuff is so important for a Bible believing Christian. You know, so many people want to say, hey, it's my faith. It's only this. It's only that. Why are we looking into these other things? Why does that matter to us as Christians?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And I think the best answer for that, you know, why does it matter to me? Why is it important? Well, the scripture says there's nothing new under the sun. And, if we don't learn from the past, we tend to repeat the same mistakes. And, I think if we don't understand the biblical perspective, that the historicity of the Old Testament is true. And although we don't have, every single thing that's ever been, said in the Old Testament, discovered in archaeology, a lot has been confirmed in archaeology that relates to the Bible, whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament. And that's including sources outside of the Bible or outside of the biblical land of Israel. So this is one of those places. It's biblical Asia Minor, which is now in Turkey. The modern translation, or I guess the modern day pronunciation of Turkey now, is Turkey-A. And so Jed tends to say Turkey-A. We change that spelling in the book, but it's the same thing. And so it's important because the rocks are crying out of the ground that that confirm biblical historicity. And I think this is one of those sites in Southeast Turkey that confirm what the Bible has said about man coming up out of the flood, post Ice Age. We don't have a whole lot of, details in there from the scripture, but we do know that, people dispersed about the time of the Tower of Babel, and then they spread out. And I think this is one of these early sites in Southeast Turkey that explain this, this context that the Bible's talking about when it says that the people dispersed. And so I think this is why it's important, because if we can understand what happened from an archaeological site back then, it actually rings true today. What they were doing there is still ringing true today. And it affects how we see the world. It affects our perspective, but it gives us a clearer understanding about what I call the policy of evil that's waxing worse in the earth. And because of that policy of evil, where we know that's heading, this is part of the very, very beginnings of that story. And if we know that, then I think we can understand how that affects us today, and then how we can counteract it.
No doubt about it. Now, as to go along the same lines, I think it also gives you that apologetic look, right? Because we want to, it says, and we say this verse pretty much every show about something, but 1 Peter 3:15 says, right, always be able to give a reason for the hope that you have. So if I'm sitting there and I'm called, you know, and I have just my faith and I say, yeah, I believe this 100%, but I have somebody who's a skeptic come to me and I can say, well, look at this, look at this, look at this. God calls us to live by faith alone, but he has given us so much proof, so many things, archaeological proof all around the world that points to the truth. And I think when you uncover things like this, when you go to places like this and you bring this to the public eye, people see that it only validates, it only strengthens my faith, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's called evidential apologetics. Mm-hmm. While it's not needed for people who are already of faith like ourselves, in other words, I don't need to find Noah's Ark to believe in my faith anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't have to have Noah's Ark. It's not necessary for me to believe in my faith more than I do already. Would it embolden my faith? Sure. Would it help someone change their mind that's leaning on the fence? Hey, I need to reconsider this. Yes. So I think that's important, because evidential apologetics is about that. It's about empirical evidence. And if you can use empirical evidence to show some who may say, well, you know, okay, it's what you believe. Well, it's a belief based in evidential apologetics, which apologetics just means a defense of the faith. So, but there's evidence. I don't like to use the word proof. I like to use the word confirm, because I think it confirms these passages in the Old Testament. For instance, we see that for years, archaeologists said that the Hittites never existed, but yet the Bible has mentioned the Hittites 47 times. And it wasn't until later that evidence for the Hittites was actually found. They found the entire culture. They just had missed it. And then when you go to the museum in Ankara, the whole museum is filled with Hittite artifacts. So it's important, because now we have evidence of the Hittites. And this is true throughout, you know, many, many places, names, cities, people, battles, that's occurred, that's been confirmed in archaeology. And that's why archaeology is important. You know, this is why the Dead Sea Scrolls are the greatest archaeological find that stands to this day. And this was discovered in 1947. But what the Dead Sea Scrolls did was it confirmed the veracity of your Old Testament scriptures word for word. And it pushed that text back in time, because we don't have the originals. We have copies of copies of copies. But then someone says, well, those copies are just messed up. And how do we know? Well, it's because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. When you go back, the Dead Sea Scrolls actually pushed the oldest text back of the scripture back 1,000 years further in time. So the oldest that we had at the time was the Aleppo Codex. Now we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they push it back 1,000 years more in time. And the great Isaiah scroll, which I have a copy here in my home, was found completely intact. And of course, it's written in Hebrew, but when you transliterate it over to the Greek and to the English, it's the same. The book of Isaiah, from the Dead Sea Scroll to your version, now depending on what version of, you know, what if you're reading the King James versus the Revised or the English Standard, etc. But it's essentially word for word. It's unchanged. And so we have a reliability of the text that's been confirmed in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's just one example. But that's one of the greatest examples, because we can say this was not made up by people who just wanted to invent a new religion. It wasn't made up, because the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is pre-Christianity. And so we see that every book of the Old Testament has been confirmed, with the exception of the book of Esther. And but multiple copies of of the Torah, multiple copies of Psalms, Isaiah have been discovered. Now, a lot of them are in fragments, but the great Isaiah scroll was completely intact. So it's a wonderful thing when archaeology comes to light. And of course, I was part of the team that excavated Dead Sea Scroll Cave 12 in Qumran in 2017. And we discovered new material cultural evidence that points it back to the Second Temple period at the same time when the Dead Sea Scrolls were written. And so we found evidence of a Dead Sea Scroll cave fragments where they used to house some Dead Sea Scrolls. And so we found remnants of those things. Matter of fact, our cave was the first documented cave ever out of the 11 original caves. Ours was the first cave to have a scroll, although it was a small scroll, to be documented inside a scroll jar. So that's interesting. A lot of people don't know that, but Roland DeVoe only excavated formally four of the caves because it was a race against the Bedouins at the time, who eventually found out how much a scroll was worth. And so there was no, you know, antiquity control like there is now. So a lot of those were being sold on the black market. So yeah, it's interesting.
Spiritual warfare, you know, the timing of those, that finding was just amazing to me, because like you said, they were discovered in 47, but it was just a few months prior that those Nag Hammadi, those Gnostic texts were found down there in Egypt. And that the whole world news was, you know, oh, Jesus is caught kissing Mary, and oh, there's this, and there's all these changes. Your Bible is not trustworthy, you know, and all this stuff. That was what was making, you know, headline news everywhere. And then it was kind of like, you know, God was like, no, here, let me show you this. And it's just a few months later, we found these scrolls.
Right. There was a big push by the Gnostics to thwart the very beginnings of the church in the first century. As a matter of fact, Paul, the Apostle Paul, states that the spirit of the Antichrist was at work in his day, and it was already coming against the church. And this was evidence in Gnosticism, where they tried to blend New Age roots with Christianity. It says, well, your Christian faith isn't really Christian. It's blended from a Gnostic blend of other spiritual beliefs. And that's not true at all. So there was a big push even in Paul's time to stop the very foundations of the church. And we see it in many other cases too, but this is what I love about archaeology, because you know, new things are coming out of the ground all the time that confirm the biblical historicity of the text. And most times these finds are not by archaeologists. They're by just normal people, farmers who are out and about and who find, and this is how they discovered Göbekli Tepe. I mean, it was misidentified in the 60s as a Byzantine cemetery. But then later, a farmer was plowing the field, hit a big, you know, a big rock. He saw that it had been hand-hewn and cut. And so he, you know, he tried to pull that thing out of the ground. He couldn't do it. He finally realized it was too big, too massive. So he called, you know, some of the archaeologists in, and they called Klaus Schmidt in, who happened to just finish up an excavation. He was the one who actually started the excavations at Göbekli Tepe back in the 90s. And Klaus immediately recognized that it was not a Byzantine cemetery, something totally different.
Now, that's a great segue you just put right there. You line that up perfectly.
He steered us back on track.
He brought the ship. He's bringing the ship into the dock there. But you're in Dr. Burton's book, Decoding Göbekli Tepe. Biblical Anatolia and the Watchers. Now, I love anything. Anytime I hear the Watchers, I get excited. I'll just be honest. That that's just something going back. We've done whole studies on Enoch and looking through, you know, what Daniel 10 tells us, things of that nature. So you see that in action in the scriptures as well. But I'd like you to kind of go through and tell us, I guess, a basic overview at first of what is the significance of Göbekli Tepe or Göbekli Tepe and what was it used for?
So what's the significance of Göbekli Tepe? Well, when Klaus Schmidt realized it was not a Byzantine cemetery, he quickly realized that he thought it was Neolithic, which is before the, you know, before the invention of pottery, pre-pottery, Neolithic, A, PPNA. So as he began to excavate initially, and look, it took about 10 years to excavate enclosure D alone. So now they've excavated several of these enclosures, but there's about 20 still buried under the ground. This is a big 20-acre site. And so a lot of these are still buried under the ground, unexcavated. But what's the significance? Once they realized the that these, you know, Göbekli Tepe, if it's Stone Age, Neolithic, there was a big surprise for them, because here you have monumental megalithic structures in stone that's not supposed to be there. And because of that, it really baffled them, because this is not expected. This was something that Stone Age man was not supposed to be able to do. Yet you have an organization of labor, a division of labor. You have people coming together. It's estimated that probably at least 500 men that it would take to build Göbekli Tepe. Of course, they think it was occupied for at least 1,000 years, maybe more. The purpose of the site is interesting, because that's the big question. What was the purpose of it? And as I began to research for the book, I kind of really honed in on Enclosure D, because in Enclosure D, you have those two central T-pillar columns that are 18 and a half foot tall. And they're anthropomorphic, which means that they're human-like. No face, but they have arms wrapping around in the navel. They have a belt. They have a fox belt loincloth. And they're anthropomorphic. They're huge, 18 and a half foot tall. So I wanted to know what those were. And why are they built so huge? But they're monolithic. They're cut and dressed out of a single piece of limestone that was quarried 1/4 mile away from the site, uphill, and then set up, you know, carved and then set up in position. This is not an easy task, and it really baffled archaeologists. So you have the very beginnings of megalithic architecture at the site by Stone Age people who are not supposed to have this kind of knowledge or, you know, technology to be able to do this. So it's really a very big surprise for archaeologists. What Dr. Burton says is the paradigm that's changing the paradigm. Why? Because it's exactly the opposite of how textbooks teach, you know, the cultural evolution of man, which I don't hold to that paradigm. And Göbekli Tepe is a great example of that, because in the textbooks, it says that, you know, the way civilization evolved was that people got together, you know, they started cultivating the grains and the wheat, and they began to settle. They had the sedentary life. And because of that, they formed communities, and then, you know, cities and towns. They walled up, you know, their defenses and to protect themselves or food. And then after all that, then you have religion that comes into play, because you got people, and then so religion comes last. Göbekli Tepe says, nope. Religion came first before all that. And this is where Judd and I come in on this, because we say we are hypothesizing. that Göbekli Tepe has brought them together for a religious ideology first. And then they came together and built Göbekli Tepe because they had a common religious ideology that was embedded in their cosmology. And so what I like to do is, you know, try to widen out the lens a little bit and figure out what's the general context of the area. And so once I started doing this, I started looking at regional science around Göbekli Tepe. Nivali Chori was one of the very first ones. Karahan Tepe, Catahoulic was another one. And although this was a little bit conventional on the conventional timeline, it's post Göbekli Tepe, but this Catahoulic is very well documented. It's excavated. It's been published. They know at least 10,000 people probably lived at that site, but they shared a commonality in their religious ideology and in their architecture. And so we see similar T-column pillar sites around this region. It's not isolated at Göbekli Tepe. And they all have something that they're sharing, a common architecture. But in their iconography, it's very similar. Anthropomorphic T-pillar images, stone heads, headless phallic images, a lot of phallic images.
Yeah, Karahan Tepe is loaded. I mean, they even have a pit full of just standing phallics. Side.
And so back to your question, Steve, was what was the intent of Göbekli Tepe? And from what archaeologists has been able to put together so far, they say, well, you know, well, Klaus Schmidt said it was a temple site. Now, archaeologists don't like to use the word temple. They won't use the word temple because it points to religion. And it's, you know, so they're not going to use that word. And I get it. You know, they're trying to stay objective. And you should. But I think Klaus was right in his beginning, very beginning thoughts that Göbekli Tepe held a religious commonality for them to build that site. It was based off a religious idea. And so whether you call it a temple or not, people lived at the site. They first thought, no, they didn't live there. They came and they went. Now they know that they lived at the site. They found hundreds of grinding stones, pestles and mortars. Of course, they're stone vessels. A word just came out just recently that a complete kitchen was found at Karahan Tepe, complete with two ovens, stone ovens, stone vessels, and it's just like they left it. So something was happening in this region, but they were all connected through architecture and through this cosmology that they shared a very similar belief. And so the intention now turns when you investigate the site through this perspective of, okay, what is the commonality here? Why is there common architecture? What's happening in the area? And so that's where I really come in to take a wider lens of the region and try to discover what they were doing and who they were and why they were there. And this, all these questions about what the intention was. And I think that after 5 years of research, should I not have finally come to a reasonable, hypothesis on what they were doing at the site.
Now that ties in really well with one of Dr. Burton's theories that I've heard before is that his idea was the Tower of Babel was actually not where mainstream archaeology would have told us more or less, but he thinks it's down closer in the area that is Turkey is where it was originated. So it would make sense that if we're seeing the first early cultures post Tower of Babel, that would have similar structures before they went out further, it would be all in that area. Does that, I mean, does that track by what you guys believe?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Judd and Derek Gilbert and others have done some really good work on the Tower of Babel site. And, you know, this is not the Ur of Iraq. We're talking about the Ur of southeastern Turkey. This is near the site of Göbekli Tepe, near modern day Şanlıurfa. It's about 9 miles away. It's biblical Edessa. This is where Abraham, when he grew up as Abram, he lived in this area. His father was named Terah. And Terah and the people in that region all worshiped the same deity, and that was the moon god. And so we see that the moon god is venerated not only in this area along the plains of Haran, but in sites that were contemporaneous with Göbekli Tepe, such as Jericho. They worship the moon god there. Other sites, such as Sogmatar, they venerated the moon god. And so, this is one of my questions that I tried to answer was, who were these people and where do you place them from the story of, you know, from the time frame of the flood, coming out of the flood, Tower of Babel, where would you put them at? And I wrestled with this for a long time, but I think you put it post Tower of Babel. Why do I say that? It's because post Tower of Babel, you have the confusion of the languages that happened. You have a lot of things happening in this time frame, but one of the things is that you have is a scattering, and you have a diversion of tongues, and people began to go there. You know, according to how you could understand, you know, your language, you would have to go with the people that could understand you. And I think that we see evidence of language at Göbekli Tepe. And this is another hypothesis I'm putting forth, is that there's evidence of Anatolian hieroglyphics at Göbekli Tepe. And if that's true, Göbekli Tepe is perhaps not Neolithic at all. It's it would culturally redate it. Anatolian hieroglyphics are based in a language called the Luvians, who were contemporaneous with the Hittites. The Luvians had a language that they used. They had two formal languages that they used. One was called the logogram, and the logogram was basically one word represents an idea. The Hittites adopted this Luvian logogram into their culture, but the logograms were hieroglyphic in that a picture represented a word. So you could, you know, they reserved this type of language for formal documentation on stone, probably to record a ritual or a ceremony, but it was a formal written language just in stone. They didn't use it any time else. It was just, you know, you have limited space and you want to make the use of your space, so you can't just write out a whole bunch of stuff. So logograms were perfect for that. And so if this is language, then I think then we get back to the question of who the people were at Göbekli Tepe, and then it, you know, and then from that perspective, you can kind of piece together maybe who they were and based on the language theory model of Luvian logograms. This is not supposed to be there. You can't push that language back that far in time. Now, they date Göbekli Tepe at about 9600 BC. But if you go with the biblical chronologies, that's either through the genealogies using the Masoretic text or the Septuagint timelines, I don't see how you can really get back that far. from a biblical timeline chronology perspective. So I took two timelines, which was the Masoretic text and the Septuagint, and to try to figure out where Göbekli Tepe would land on those timelines biblically. And it doesn't come out to 9600 BC. So so you either have to push that language back 7,000 years, which, you know, it's just not going to happen. Or that time needs to come forward, and that 7,000 years isn't really there. Now, that's kind of bizarre, because you have most most archaeologists who believe in the secular timeline of the chronologies, which, you know, in even, you know, even Christian archaeologist or biblical archaeologist, you know, have a longer earth viewpoint. Dr. Burton does. And so I happen to come at it from a perspective of a young earth. But I think because of, you know, where you put Göbekli Tepe, it determines, you know, who the people were at the site. And so I think these are important questions to look at when you're trying to decide, you know, where to put them. And I think you put them after the Tower of Babel because of the language. And this is after the scattering, you got the diverse languages that's coming out. And if this is Luwian logograms or Anatolian hieroglyphics, this is where you would put it. So I've got it, you know, I got a chronology chart in the back of the book that you can visually look at both timelines, the Septuagint timeline and the Masoretic text. And I think you would be surprised at where you go Göbekli Tepe lands.
With those big T pillars, and for those that's not aware, Dr. Aaron Judkins has written another book called Guardians of Göbekli, and that was a great book. Highly recommend you check it out. But you had proposed some ideas in there that I found fascinating when I first got exposed to them. And you were talking about the two huge T-pillars and how they were so much taller. And you mentioned this just a few moments ago, but there's also like smaller T-pillars gathered around them. And like you said, it's got the hands on the belly and the belt. It's kind of like they're, yeah, like gazing down, you know, kind of like the whole, you know,
yeah,
when the gods walked amongst men, you know, the giants. And it's kind of like, even like with church, you know, you have these crucifixes, the Virgin Mary, these towering, you know, figures that look down upon the congregation or the people. Was these huge pillars in the center like to represent, do you think, the moon god or the sun and the moon god, or just ancestor veneration type deal? What's your opinions on that?
Yeah, so that's the first thing that captured my attention was those anthropomorphic pillars in enclosure D, because they're so tall. They're 18 and a half foot tall. No face, but they got these arms. You know, I had a guy reach out, and he goes, "Hey, what do you think about, you know, what it looks like a belt. They're wearing a belt." I said, "That's not a belt." You know, so it looks like a belt, but they're artistic motifs. That's not a belt. Well, I was wrong. They're belts, because they're wearing fox pelt loincloths, mm-hmm, both of them. And so when I realized I was wrong on that, I said, those are belts, and those are fox pelt loincloths in the front that they're wearing. So, man, I started digging in, and you just go back to an earlier thing that you said, was that I had written a book called Guardians of Göbekli. That book is no longer available because Decoding Göbekli Tepe now is the revised version of Guardians of Göbekli Tepe. So that's the updated content material with Dr. Burton. So Guardians is no longer in print. But but look, these two anthropomorphic images were very intriguing. And I, as I said earlier, there was no central source where I could just go and find all this information. I mean, it took me years of research to pull this all together into a single source. And I've footnoted and referenced everything. A lot of these sources are secular sources that I footnoted in here. But look, when you start looking at the region. Okay, so you know, this is how I solved the Los Lunas Mystery Stone in New Mexico. It's got this ancient Paleo Hebrew out there on a big 80-10 boulder. It's called the Decalogue Stone. It's got the bridge version of the Ten Commandments. It's isolated. And I made multiple trips out there in 2012 over a period of a year or so. But how I solved that was I took a step back and looked at the region in context. Now, this is the same approach that I took at Göbekli Tepe. I said, okay, let me widen out what I call the 35,000 foot view approach, and let me see what's happening in the area. So I saw a commonality in the architecture. I saw similar T-pillar sites around Göbekli Tepe. I saw the same iconography of the animals, vultures, serpents, a lot of phallic images, headless phallic images, anthropomorphic images, faceless stones, stones with faces. But the one thing that got my attention was that up on the neck area of these two anthropomorphic images, on Western Pillar 31 was the image of a bull with horns. On Eastern Pillar 18, which is an enclosure D, it's an emblem, iconography of a crescent moon. It's got a disc above it. And then right above that, it looks like an English H. It's not the letter H, but it looks like that. So that's the best way I can describe it. And then on another stone in one of the enclosures, there was a clear emblem for a logogram that that we knew of, alluvian logogram, and it was just the logogram for Deus. And Deus in Latin is God. And this is a very clear symbol, logogram, which is Anatolian hieroglyphic, this logogram for Deus, which is God. And underneath it was the logogram, which was this logogram that stood for house or place. So here you have a probable meaning on this one stone alone, house or temple or place of the gods. And so, what was the images on the anthropomorphic two central pillars in enclosure D, these 18 and a half foot tall faceless stones that are staring down at you? Well, there's logograms for that. And the logogram, now a lot of the logograms aren't deciphered, but hundreds are. There's hundreds that are not. And there's just a few people who are expert in Luvian logogram. And I'm really surprised that some of the linguists have not come out yet on this about Göbekli Tepe. But look, if I'm right, these are logograms. The logograms on Western Pillar 31 is a logogram for the bull. That's an easy one, right? You got the image of the bull with horns, no-brainer. So on Eastern Pillar 18, you have the iconography of the crescent moon about where the neck is. And when I started doing the research in the logograms about what this was, then it suddenly became a little bit clearer. When you're looking at it in terms of the logograms, but also when you look at the Mesopotamian Sumerian culture, and particularly the Sumerian language, it can help you identify some of the cosmology in their words, in their vocabulary. And so there's a Sumerian linguistic connection that I write about in the book that I think pinpoints the identification of these two pillars. And I lay the foundation out in the book, but I'll just talk about one of them. One of them is a connection for Adam. And I'm just gonna look here. When you're looking at the Sumerian pantheon, that the very top deity of the Sumerian pantheon was a god An. And when you break it down in Sumerian, A is the logogram, which refers back to the father or the ancestor, and it's pictured by an ox or a bull. Now, when you combine the A with the, which means father, okay, so the A means father or ancestor, but the picture of that is the bull. So we see this actually in Paleo Hebrew. Mm-hmm. The Aleph in Paleo Hebrew, because it's pictographical, is a picture of the ox, which means strength or strong. This is where we get our English letter A from. So when you combine it with the letter N for An. Okay, so we're talking about the Sumerian deity An. So A is father, but the N in Sumerian would be to lift up on high or to make highest. And when you combine these two terms, it's the deity An to lift up or make high. Now, when you look at this in the proto cuneiform script, you see that this Sumerian word that is referring back to an ox or a bull, and again, this is on Western Pillar 31 with that iconography of the bull image up there. When you combine the letter A in Sumerian, which means father, with the ox, which is the AMA or AM, which is the wild bull or the ox, because you get the image of the ox, it gives us a really significant clue. And that translates to the name of our first ancestor, which is, get this, it's Adama, which is biblical Adam.
Hmm.
Okay, so this is where we get the father arc bull imagery from. Let me just simplify this. They have deified their ancestor Adam. And the way they have deified him was through the Sumerian bull god An, to lift up, to make high. What's interesting is there's another tie to the sons of the Anakim. When the children of Israel are going into the land, the sons of Anak are there. The sons of Anak, the sons of An, the sons of Anak, who were part of that Nephilim tribe. And then you get into the Raphaim giants and all this. These are the sons of Anak. They have deified their father Adam as a god. And so they've done it in Sumerian pantheon. They've done this in the deification, but in the veneration of Western Pillar 31 in Enclosure D at Göbekli Tepe. So that pillar is a representation of Adam. Now, we don't have the face, we don't have the sexes, but why do you need two central monolithic stones covering up their nakedness with fox pelt loincloths wearing belts?
Sounds familiar.
It only makes sense if you put it into the original biblical narrative of Adam and Eve. They have deified their original ancestors. And so we see that Adam has been deified in the bull image. We know that the people of the Neolithic was known as the People of the Bull, and they have done something different. They have taken the image of the moon and they've deified that, but now they have taken the image of the bull and they've deified that, because the bull is the strongest thing. That's, you know, it's a powerful creature. And those ancient Auroch bulls that used to live in those ancient plains of Haran, they probably stood 9 foot at the shoulder. So if you take one of them down, it'll probably take a dozen men or more, take one of those creatures down. Well, that provides a lot of meat for your family, your community. Mm-hmm. But they were very powerful creatures. So they have deified the image of the bull as a power over the earth. They've deified the image of the moon as in the power over the heavens. So we see that there's a veneration coming into play here at Göbekli Tepe with their ancestors. And so the standing stones, we see all throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, there used to be some 50,000 standing stones. The most famous is Stonehenge, standing stone. They're called menhirs. Menhirs is a term broken down to mean long stones or standing stones. There's something happening there because these standing stones represent either ancestors or they are venerating their ancestors through these stones. And this is why you have a lot of stone imagery that is anthropomorphic. They're human-like. Some of them do have human faces carved into these stones. We see Urfaman. They found it there in Şanlıurfa. Dates back to the same time as Göbekli Tepe, and it's 6 foot tall. And it's a full stone statue of a person. It's kind of got a V-neck collar, a double V-neck collar. This is getting back to the same imagery of this phallic imagery you see, especially at Karahan Tepe. But why would you need dead people with no heads to have phallic images? Doesn't make sense when you look at it that way. But if you look at it through their cosmology, we see that when you died or when your loved one died, they believed that for you to be reborn, you had to go to the underworld. You had to go to the netherworld and get reborn, but you died.
Path of souls.
So yeah, so you would go through this process of dying in the underworld. And this all has to go back to this regeneration theory we put out in the book, that when you died, you were regenerated. Your spirit was regenerated, but first it had to go through this death, you know, this period of death in the netherworld before it gets reborn back into the afterlife. And they were reborn into the afterlife back to the heavens as a star god. And so they believe that the only way you could do that was through their ancestors, Adam and Eve, who they've deified. And so this is why you have some of the skull fragments found at Göbekli Tepe, where they've repatriated part of the skulls. You don't need the whole body, just the skull. And a lot of these skull fragments have holes drilled in them, probably where they could suspend them in the air. But look, there's a big shadow play probably going on. These enclosures were probably roofed with wooden poles. So it wouldn't be open in the sky like we see it now. It'd be roofed. And in enclosure D, we see it a processional way before you get into the main enclosure. And then you see bench seating around there. We see stone vessels that have shallow grooved channels cut into them, probably for draining blood. Now, I'm not suggesting that they sacrificed humans or animals there. We do know that they practiced ritualistic feasting, but they probably did have some kind of a ritual or a ceremony they were performing in there with those skulls. And so if you want your ancestor to be reborn back into the stars, into the eternal life, back to your ancestors who they've now deified as Adam and Eve, then you got to go through this process. And I think that's what's happening at at Göbekli Tepe. It's part of a regeneration theory that they would be regenerated into the afterlife, back to the heavens as a star god through the stones. But you would have to repatriate part of those remains. We see now that they found three human burials at Göbekli Tepe. A number of images that's very similar in Çatalhöyük, where they deified the image of the bull. They buried their loved ones under the floors of their home. And so I think they were doing something very similar. Matter of fact, they would paint the skulls with red ochre paint. And this goes back to the very imagery of Adam. From the red dirt, man arises, from the red clay, from the red earth. And this is why you get the red ochre, I think, on the that they found parts of the red coloration that's left on the skulls. So it's part of this regeneration theory that we see. And this is what we're proposing in the book, that they have deified their ancestors. Yes, and they're venerating their ancestors, but they've deified these gods. And so these enclosures, I think they have probably done some kind of ritual ceremonies in there. But look, when you got firelight, you know, inside these enclosures, and the light from your torch is lighting up those 18 and a half foot structures, it's going to cast shadows on the floor and the walls. And to them, a shadow was a representation of a shade or a spirit. And so when these shades, these shadows start dancing and flickering on the sides of the wall and the floor, they become spirits. And so now they are entering a spirit world, but more specifically, they have recreated the symbolic womb of Eve, because now they're going to rebury you back into a womb, back into the womb of Eve. So you can be reborn as a spirit, as a star god. But the only way to do that is back to your mother Eve. And so Göbekli Tepe, at least in part, represents a symbolic womb. We see Göbekli Tepe, the very name means pregnant hill. Göbekli Tepe, Tepe is a hill. Göbekli means pregnant or Pot-bellied.
So,
the literal translation is pregnant hill, and this is exactly what we see. It's a symbology of the womb. So we walk it out. We lay this foundation in the book, so you have an understanding of how we get there, and we get into the Sumerian linguistic connections and all. But there's an interesting site over in England called Avebury. I may be pronouncing it wrong. I haven't been there, but it's one of the largest megalithic stone sites in England. And there's an interesting connection, I think, connects to Göbekli Tepe in the name. And a lot of archaeologists didn't understand what Avebury was. But when you break down the name Avebury in Sumerian, suddenly it becomes very clear. When you break down that word bury, B-U-R-Y in English, and you break it down, you see that there's something happening regarding to the death and the afterlife of that person. And it has to do with this regeneration of the dead. Bury is to have the dead be buried in a pit. But to them, you were being reborn back into the afterlife. And so you get this linguistic connection that their spirit is being regenerated through this crushing and this fires of the netherworld, so they can be reborn, and then they get reborn back to the heavens. But they get reborn specifically back through Eve. And so when you translate the Old English Ave, A-V-E, Avebury, then you have a very clear linguistic connection. It is relates back to a burial womb of Eve, which I think is interesting. It's the a remembrance of the burial practices that is venerating Eve, Avbury, Eve. And so it's, I think this is exactly what's happened back at Göbekli Tepe. And we see, in chapter 9, there's a whole chapter dedicated to the mother goddess, that throughout all these ancient cultures, you have heard of her under the names Inanna, under the names Ishtar and Ashtar worship. Getting back to the more modern day sightings of the lady, simply known as the lady in a lot of these Catholic sightings, that is an apparition of Mary, supposedly, who has termed itself the lady. And so I write in afterward in the book that talks about why it's important, going back, well, why is this site even important? Well, I'll tell you in the afterword of the book why it's important, because this apparition is happening, at least in the Catholic realms, where this is witnessed by hundreds or thousands of people. Even the Catholic Church has come out and authenticated these sightings of the lady. So this is all going back to a deification of Eve, but they have venerated both and their ancestors. And so this is part of the lost connection that the ancients once had in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve walked with God. But when sin entered, and listen, sin entered the earth. It may have entered the earth through Adam and Eve, because they really had the keys to the kingdom. They had a choice. And they didn't choose, you know, if you could go back to the movie term, they didn't choose wisely. But look, sin entered Lucifer first. And, you know, I talk about this, I cite Michael Heiser's work in here, but we have this imagery of Lucifer as a serpent in the garden, and that Eve is talking to a serpent. Eve's not talking to a serpent. So when you look at it in the Hebrew, this is not a serpent that Eve is talking to. It's the Nakash. The Nakash means a luminous shining one, or shining being, brazen shining one. And we know Lucifer is an angel of light, a bearer of light, the light bearer. And so it makes sense that Eve is not startled when she sees a celestial being that is luminous and shining. She's not startled by it, because she is also in a glorified state. This is before sin, before they fell. So it's not any surprise to her. So, you know, she's able to have this conversation. But the thing that this entity gets her to do was it planted two questions in her mind. It didn't command her to do anything. She's the one that actually took action, but she took action on the thought. And that was, did God say? And there was another question in there, and it slips in my mind right now, but he gets her to question God's authority. Did God say that you would surely die?
You're gonna
be like gods. That's right. And there's a grain of truth in there. Was a grain of truth in there. Yeah, you're gonna have your eyes open, but the rest of it was spun around the lies of deception, and that was to get her to. There was a disobedient act, and so when God comes in the garden and he goes, "Hey, where are you guys?" He's not wondering, because he can't find them. He knows what's happened. He's asking them a rhetorical question, and the rhetorical question is this: what have you done that you're hiding? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we're scared because we're naked. Well, who told you? Why would you be scared? Who told you he was naked? And this, again, is the imagery that we see on the stones at Göbekli Tepe. They made themselves coverings. So this is exactly what we see on the two images at Göbekli Tepe on these stones, coverings on stone images. And something very interesting also is that these arms that wrap around to the side, you see they come to the navel. These arms are telegraphing divinity. They're not just, it's not just an arm. It is arms. But it is, the arms are telegraphing divinity. Just like the ichthyophallic images that we see on these stones are telegraphing something important. Why would a headless dead man be ichthyophallic? It's not humanly possible because you're dead. But if you're being regenerated into the afterlife, then suddenly we see that the dead is being regenerated in their cosmology. The phallic images are the continuation of the line. So that's why you have this headless imagery all over the region. You see it, but a lot of, especially Karahan Tepe, that big one, it shows the ribs. You know, this person is actually, you know, it's a person that's probably represented in death, but it's ichthyophallic. Why? Because this goes back to the symbol of when you die, you are being regenerated back to our ancestors, back to our father ancestors. And this is exactly the imagery that we see at Göbekli Tepe.
Wow. I got to get this new updated book.
Yeah, I think we all do. I think everybody out there is going to need it as well.
There was so much more information that's in decoding Göbekli Tepe now. Of course, we got Judd's content in there, and we just updated it because more information was coming out from the site, and particularly we found just nuggets that we were able to piece back in there. But in particularly what we're talking about now with the veneration, the deification of Adam and Eve, especially is all new. And look, I think we lay a very solid groundwork. And the matter of fact, a guy that commented on one of the channels, he said, "Well, I don't believe that ever happened." Well, have you read the book? Well, no, I haven't read the book. But you're going to make a judgment because you just don't think it's possible. Look, here's what I'm asking: just read it. And then let's have a discussion about it, you know. But I know it's hard when you don't have all the information. We don't have a lot of time to get into the details, about it. But look, it's all laid out in the book and it's referenced. I mean, you can go back and look at the sources. If you read the footnotes, you'll get a solid education in the footnotes, not just on Göbekli Tepe. You're going to get a solid education in a lot of different areas that the book touches on. I mean, I had to go into areas I didn't ever dream I was going to have to go into the book, but you know, when you're talking about coming out of the flood, you got to talk about that. Well, how does that happen? Why do I think it's post-flood? Because the stones at Göbekli Tepe are limestone. That's all post-flood material, sedimentary rock. It's all laid down during the flood. It's post-flood limestone. So that's after the flood. So I have to talk about that. Well, I have to get into the chronology, the biblical chronology. Where do you put that? Well, I started building this timeline just as a visual to help me keep track of where I was at with what was going on. So I just did it for me, and it just became this thing where I just added to it, changed it. And you'll see in several versions early on that I've changed this up quite a bit because you keep moving things around, and at least on the Septuagint timeline, you have more time to move these things around. Now, I want to make something clear. I study out of the King James. I'm not a King James only guy. You know, I'll study out of other versions, but that's, you know, that's my primary text. I study out, which is based off the Masoretic text. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong in the doctrine of it, but there is some genealogy problems when you get it in the Genesis genealogies, the Masoretic text, I think it's in Genesis.
Yeah, they try to make 11. Shem Melchizedek because they wanted a point away from Jesus.
Well, it cuts off their genealogies by 100 years each. And so if the Septuagint reads, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he was 130 years, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he was 110 years. Well, the Masoretic text is going to say, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he was 30 years. It'll cut that 100 years off. And so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he was 20 years. It cuts that 100 years off. And so when you go six generations, that's 600 years of time right there that you're missing. Minimum. The Septuagint, I think you gain back 1350 or 1400 years of time, which now you suddenly have a lot more time for an ice age. And you got to talk about the ice. You got to talk about the ice age now and the Younger Dryas event. Where do you put all that? Well, there's not room in the Masoretic text timeline. And that's the text I study out of. There's nothing wrong with it doctrinally. I'm just saying that in the Masoretic timeline, by the time you get out of the flood to the Tower of Babel, you only have 100 years of time. And you're telling me that you got 100 years to repopulate the earth and have, you know, whatever it is of a population of people to build the Tower of Babel? I don't think 100 years is enough time. But if you go according to the Septuagint, now you have a lot of time. You have all the room you need for the Ice Age to occur. With the mechanism being the flood, you have all the time that you need for the repopulation of the earth to get to the Tower of Babel to have the population there. You have the time, but not in the Masoretic text, you don't. But again, the Septuagint has its own problems, not doctrinally, but just in some minor areas. It has Methuselah living 14 years after the flood. We know he died probably a week before the flood. His name meant his death shall bring. So, his death brought the flood, and probably within a week when he died, the flood came. So we know he didn't live 14 years after the flood. So there's some problems with that. But look, I think if you take both of them and study out of them, I think the Septuagint has faithfully preserved the genealogies, where at some course, some point along the way in the Masoretic timeline, for whatever reason, those genealogies get cut short. And I think it was probably to nullify Christ as Messiah.
I think so too.
And so there's reasons, speculative reasons we get into in the book briefly, but this book has taken me a lot of places I didn't expect to write. So we get into a little bit into the mechanism of the flood, the ice age, what happened to the mammoths, some about, you know, those things. And of course the Younger Dryas event, and then the biblical chronology. And, so you'll get a whole education in the book as you read it, but we want the goal is to let you decide. I'm not trying to be dogmatic here and saying I'm right. I don't know. Only 5% of Göbekli Tepe roughly has been excavated. 95% still under the ground. And now there's reports that, you know, the site, you know, that they're going to slow down excavations. Some say that they're stopping altogether. I haven't heard that from the director of the German Institute of Archaeology. Said they're slowing down. They're not stopping, but they're continuing. And I think they're doing good work at the site. I would love to be there one day. I'd love to meet them. I would love to be able to excavate there. They're open. And this is from a testimony that I call it testimony. It's an interview, but you know, it was an interview he gave. And he said, we're open, you know, to considering other people's interpretations. And there's been a little bit of pushback, I think, in the past, but I think they've kind of ironed those things out. And he said, look, we have to be open to other possibilities in the public, and I would love to sit down and talk with him. I love to excavate there. So none of this is to disparage their work at all. I think they're doing a fantastic job. There's just because you're not there, and information is slow to get outside because it has to be published. It, there is information now that they know that we don't know that won't get to us in another 1 or 2 years, maybe longer. So this information sometimes is really slow coming out because of all this, but I think they're doing what they can. I know there's a lot of conspiracy theories about they're trying to cover up the site and they don't want any further excavations done. And I don't believe any of that, but I would like for them to give this an honest, open hearing. One, about the regeneration theory. Two, about the veneration, the deification of their ancestors, specifically Adam and Eve. Three, that there's Anatolian hieroglyphics on these stones, specifically Luwian logograms, which is language. If it's language and if it's Luwian, you can't put it in the Neolithic. You can't. So the only other alternative is to culturally redate Göbekli Tepe, not to the Neolithic, but probably to the Bronze Age, which, if you're using the conventional timeline, moves Göbekli Tepe 7,000 years. Well, those 7,000 years probably didn't really exist in the biblical time frame, but in their mind, it does. And so how do you do that? Well, they don't like it when you move revised time frames around. They had a pretty harsh disagreement with David Rohl, who tried to revise Egyptian chronology and just move it 200 years.
Yeah, it was like 200 years.
So I happen to lean towards David Rohl's work on the revised Egyptian chronology. I cite him in the book. I think he's done a wonderful job. But look, is he right? I think he probably perhaps is right, but that's part of archaeology. We just keep digging until more information and data comes out of the ground, until we actually can put some hard data on it. Empirical evidence that says, okay, this is, now we know for sure this is it, and we just don't know enough information yet coming out of Göbekli Tepe. But I think David Rohl's theory is good. Others don't, and they follow someone else's work on that. That's fine. I'm open to reading both. I'm open, but I do cite David Rohl's work in the book because I think he comes closest to the biblical time frame of the Egyptian timeline. And look, he's not even a Christian. He's probably an agnostic at best, from my understanding. And he's the only one saying the story in the Old Testament about the Exodus is true. Just looking at archaeology, which I found absolutely fascinating. I would love to sit down and talk with him. And I think you could have a great conversation with people like David Rohl, because you're going to hear things that you're probably not going to hear before, and you got to consider all these things. And that's all I ask with this book, is just have a hearing to make a consideration and see, if our theory really is going to pan out. And my prediction is, guys, is that if they do more excavations along the way, I think Luwian logograms, these Anatolian hieroglyphics, are going to get confirmed. I think they're going to find more. And these Luwian linguists are going to come out and go, guys, this is no question now. This is Luwian. And if it's Luwian, you can't put it in the Neolithic. And I explain why. It looks Stone Age. Why does it look Stone Age? Because there's no pottery there. Well, they say, if there's no pottery, this has got to be Stone Age. But does it? They're using the natural resources around them. What do you got? You got a lot of stone. You don't have a lot of clay for pottery, but you got a lot of stone. So what do you work with? You work with stone. You could also, there's a possibility of whiteware, but whiteware wouldn't hold up over this long of time. It would disintegrate and dissolve over this much of time. But you do have a lot of stone, and we do see a lot of stone vessels. And we do know that they were harvesting that wild wheat out in the plains of Iran. They were harvesting the grains. They were harvesting the barley. They were making beer with that barley. They had these big ritualistic feastings. And it was just a very natural, plentiful resource of food. Grains, antelope. They were
having an ergot tripping time in Eve's womb at night, weren't they?
Well, they probably only did that when someone died. They would probably only, you know, why do I say that? I think they use that as sacred space. They wouldn't use it all the time. It was a sacred space. Why? Because some of the floors and the walls were plastered. We see evidence of plaster at Göbekli Tepe, which is burnt, crushed lime. They took lime, burned it, crushed it, burned it. You got to get it up to a temperature, mix it in slurry. You plaster that thing out, and it gives you a really nice aesthetic look, but it can waterproof your walls, your floors. It separates that space, and it's a special place. It's reserved as a sacred space. So I don't think they would go in there all the time, but when they did, it was for a reason. I think this is part of the regeneration theory they can make sure that you made it back into the afterlife through the veneration of those ancestors, through those stones. It all sounds very foreign to us, but in I think in their mindset, until we get harder data, I think this is a really good theory about the intent for Göbekli Tepe and the anthropomorphic images and the zoomorphic images and the totemism on these stones. And we just try to lay it all out in the best way we can. But look, this is the first book, I think, on Göbekli Tepe that gives you a biblical perspective about what they were doing at the site and why they were doing it. But what they were doing in these enclosures, I think they were venerating their ancestors, and they were deifying at least two deities, and that is the moon god and the bull god.
Well, why don't you tell everybody where they can follow you, find the book? This is your shameless plug right here.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can find the book on Amazon. It released towards the end of December. It's brand new. It ran number one in new release on Amazon in three categories: in archaeology, number one; prehistory, number one; ancient knowledge, number one. We're very excited to get the book out finally to the public. You can go to my website, aaronjudkins.com. Everything's linked up there, all my work and past books, radio, TV, whatever. It's all centralized there at aaronjudkins.com. And you can go to Patreon, Ancient Pathways at Patreon. And I got a lot of free content up there for just free members. If you want to join, cup of coffee a month, there's a lot of content there for just $5 a month you can enjoy. And then if you go to Substack, I've got a new Substack account, and I'll have other things there. And it's just putting in Dr. Aaron Judkins, and my Substack account will come up, and you can join there for free and get all kinds of good stuff. I'll have another article coming out on Friday, which is tomorrow. So lots of good things there. But those are the ways you can get a hold of me. But we would appreciate any comments, feedbacks from the book. We've gotten five-star reviews so far. And we thank people for taking the time to go back and doing that. And we would ask that if you enjoyed the book, if you learned something from it, if you recommend it, go back to Amazon and just give us a review and tell us what you liked about it. So that would really help the book.
Well, thank you again so much for coming on with us. We miss Judd, obviously, but thank you so much for coming on with us. And really appreciate
it. Yeah, here it is, by the way. If you haven't seen it yet, there's those two central pillars. You see the person. This is the representation of the spirit person about to pass through the stones, back up through the light, up to the heavens. So this is it right here. We're real excited. The cover was really turned out great, and it's just full of color images and things in here. So this is a color version of the book. There's a lot of watercolor paintings that I had an artist do for me. I'll show you one of them here. So this is in color. So you can see it. You see the anthropomorphic image there, that's actually a stone found at Göbekli Tepe. And then we get into the chronology of the book. I'll show you the chronology timeline right here. And there it is right there. So it's all in color. So it just gives you a good visual. So as you're reading the book, you can see these color images. Unfortunately, they don't print color for Australia, so you can't order it in Australia or Japan.
Well, again, anyway, like I said, appreciate you, brother, very much for coming on and giving us your insight. And yeah, as always, everybody out there,
keep digging.